All right, so now there, anybody who's interested in giving a very short presentation, either raise your hand or just come on up. Okay, so there's 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, so Makiko's on? Okay. All right, so why don't you come on up first, and then we'll just all pick people up as we go along. And then at the conclusion of this, we'll just have a general free-for-all. I'll throw out some hopefully inflammatory opinions based on what I've heard in the last week, and people can then react to them. Of course, I should pick Hal for that.
Hi, I'm Hidekazu Tanaka from Tokyo Institute of Technology. Okay. So I calculated the dust growth and settlement in the solar nebula. And I also calculated the spectral energy distribution of nebula disk. So spectral energy distribution evolved due to the dust growth. Okay. And we assumed the minimum mass solar nebula disk around the solar master. And as a first step, we neglected turbulence. Yeah, so as a next step, we will consider the effect of turbulence. And to describe the dust growth and settling, we performed the numerical integration of the coagulation equation to describe dust growth. And in the equation, we added the advection term to describe the dust settling. In our calculation, spatially one-dimensional, vertical, and we use 500 mass beam to describe the dust growth. Then I calculated the disk temperature and the spectral energy distribution to calculate using two-layer model by Chen et al. 2001. This is our result on the dust size distribution. Yeah, growth and settling in the nebula gas divided two stage. First stage is the growth stage. Vertical axis is the number density integrated vertically. So it's a surface number density. And the horizontal axis is a dust radius. So it's a size distribution. And due to the dust growth, size distribution become parallel like this. And they grow like this. And after that, it dust settling onto the dust layer. And the smaller dust settle layer later, and micron-sized dust remain floating until 10 to 6 years. This time scale does not depend on the location of the disk. This calculation is at 8 AU. And we calculated similar calculation at each radius. Then I calculated the disk temperature using two-layer model. This is the temperature of surface layer, and this is the temperature disk interior. Yeah, this temperature is almost equal to the Hayashi model temperature, but in the disk interior, temperature is very low. So, okay, snow line is here. So snow line is about 0.4 AU. So it's a surprising result. Okay, and I was using our result, I calculated optical thickness or optical depth of the disk. due to the gas loss, death loss, and radial distribution of optical disks become flat. Yeah, I think it's an interesting result. And I also calculated SED of the disk. So due to the dust loss, in this calculation, gas component is just constant. But due to the dust loss, SED, the disk luminosity decreases like that. So at infrared, disk luminosity does not decrease so much, but at a millimeter wavelength, luminosity decreases about 3 order of magnitude at 10 to the 7th CF. That's all.
One question? Anybody have a question? Okay, we better move on quickly because there's six. Oh, sorry, Mark.
Oh, just point out that in these passive disk models, the temperature goes as raised to the minus 2 seconds.
Yes.
So snow line is 1.4 U argon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. Yeah. It's a surprising result. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. Who else? Okay. Say again. Okay. Next volunteer here. Okay, come on.
I've got just one slide, so I'll keep it brief. I'm Gerben Dirksen. I'm working in Tübingen with Willy Klei, and this poster is a presentation of some work that I did for the Planets Network. What we're looking at is 3D simulations of a protoplanet embedded in a disk. We use a very standard disk, and we start with a planet which is very similar to Jupiter. So one Jupiter mass and semi-major axis of 5.2 AU. And then we have some special conditions. And that is that we start on an eccentric and inclined orbit. So we start with an eccentricity of 0.05 and 5 degrees inclination. And then we look at what the orbital elements do if we let the disk react and calculate the back reaction on the planet. So what you find is what Gordon Ogilvy already predicted, that at first you get a decline in eccentricity and inclination. Unfortunately, we could not do the integrations long enough to see the decline to turn around, like he predicted. So what happens is what you can see in this plot here. First, the inclination of the planet will decline, and it will transfer some of this energy onto the disk. This plot here shows the warping of the disk. I'm not sure the colors are very clear here, but So what this is the an R5 average of the location of the disk. So at every vertical column, we looked at the center of mass of this column, and we plotted that as a function of R and phi. So this is the R direction. Here is the planet. This is 0.4 times the planet, same major axis up to 2.5. And you can see here the spirals are somehow clear in this view. So the planet is here in the middle, and we can see that this part near the planet is clearly elevated above the central plane.
Where is the star?
Star is here. That's actually all the way here, though. So this tells you that the planet is at this point in the orbit. It's not in the middle of the disk, but above it. Then the spiral goes through the disk, through the central plane, and this part of it is actually below the central plane. And then the major feature of the disk here, this part is all below the central plane, this is above it. And the dividing line is this contour here. And as you can see, it's not a very straight contour, so you can actually see some disk warping going on here. It will be very interesting to see what happens in a very long period, but we have not seen that yet. What's also interesting to note is that it does not our simulations show that although it happens that the inclination gets damped, but it doesn't seem to affect the type 2 migration that we were looking at. And we're also doing some different models at the moment, which some what was that? No. With some different initial conditions, especially different viscosities, and see how this affects the damping of the orbital elements. The poster is back there, and it's also on the internet on the homepage of this conference, so you can look at it there. And that's all I want to say. Thank you.
Okay, what we decided to do with Peter Bonnenheimer, Michał Różyczka, and Tomek Stępiński, it is to see if we can reproduce the observed correlation between metallicity of the star and the fraction of planets in the under assumption that this enhancement of metallicity is primordial one, and the planets form, giant planets form in the core accretion model. So, well, first what we have is we have a disk evolution code which can evolve the protoplanetary disk from initial conditions characterized by its initial mass, angular momentum, and size, up to the moment when the solids in the disk are in the form of a planetesimal swarms, and these swarms can be characterized by the final mass of this final planetesimal swarm, its sizes, its inner radius, outer radius, and its surface density. All important forces are included, but there are some simplifications to enable to calculate a large grid of models for different initial conditions. We take into account different parameters of alpha. It is the example of our grids for different initial masses and outer radius. And this is what we received. On the x-axis is the logarithm of the metallicity of the star. Here is the fraction of the planets. What we have done, it is that we evolve till the moment we have a planetesimal swarm, and then we checked in which models with the surface density of this planetesimal swarm is high enough to form a planet of Jupiter mass planet in 3 million years based on calculations on Peter Bodenheimer. And then we calculated the field on the grid of in which the models were uniformly distributed on the grid of the initial mass and logarithm of initial outer radius. And when we scaled in this way that we received the observed value about 20% for the metallicities three higher than the solar one. So here the observed histogram and the different colors give different alpha. The green one is alpha 10 to minus 1. The blue, dark blue one is 10 to minus 2, and the pink one is 10 to minus 3. What we see that we quite well reproduce the lower end metallicities. We receive no giant planets at the same metallicity as the observed one, but there is some problems with values here. So what we checked, it is whether it can be because we observe not all planets, but only planets which have semi-major axis less than, let's say, 5 astronomical units. And so here is the models in which giant planets could form at radius smaller than 5 astronomical units. And we see that now the lines reproduce the observations much better. What is more to emphasize that in the case of alpha 10 to minus 3, there is nearly no need, so was no need for scaling. So when we take, so in our models, roughly 20% of this metallicity in this gives the plants. So it's all.
Any questions?
Did you increase the density of heavy metals?
It was increased due to the gas drag and the redistribution of the solid.
Compared to the minimum solar metal, if you have more metallicity, does that mean you have more higher dust density?
Initially, it depends on if you take the star with the metallicity 3 higher than the solar one, we have taken the solids in the fraction of solids to the gas initially is 3 times larger than the solar one.
Okay, thank you.
window. Just a minute, I think I can make it go. Excellent. Okay, there we go. Okay, so I'm going to say a few words about a generalization of the...
Why don't you tell everyone your name?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Margaret Penn, and this is work done with my advisor, Ram Sari. Okay, so I'm going to say a few words about generalization of the Lagrange points, which are, as you all know, the fixed points that you find in the circular planar restricted three-body problem in the one-to-one resonance. So this is a schematic of both the standard and the generalized Lagrange points. Here, this figure is in the rotating frame, the frame rotating with the massive bodies in the system. You can think of them as a star here and a planet. So the standard Lagrange points are, of course, L1, L2, and L3, the little black dots shown here, and L4 and L5, the triangular points. And there are an infinite number of Lagrange point analogs, which are the other black dots shown here. And also shown are examples of tadpole and horseshoe analog orbits that you can get around the Lagrange point analogs, just as you can get standard tadpole and horseshoe orbits around the usual Lagrange points. Okay, so to explain this a little better, I'm going to show a little movie. Oops. Okay. So here's a movie. So just set the scene. We've got a massive planet orbiting a star, which you don't see here, and a massless test particle also orbiting the same star. And I'm just going to talk about their interactions. Okay. Oops. Okay. All right. Where would you go? Okay, I don't know why I'm having technical difficulties. Okay. Go. Please.
You can run it to small.
Yeah. Okay. Can you guys see the small version?
Yeah, sure.
All right. Okay. Okay. So, all right. So right now we're in the stationary frame. So we've got the planet and the massless test particle. They're in a resonance orbit, quite an eccentric one. So the important interactions only happen at periaps, and you can parameterize them by one number, which is the angle between the particle and the planet when the particle reaches periaps. So now we switch to the rotating frame. So this is the exact same orbit, but in the rotating frame. And the interaction at periaps is determined by the azimuth of the particle at periaps, which is shown by this green line here. So, okay, so since the particle has come in, it comes into periaps, it gets a kick from the planet, and then it moves. So, okay, so this is just a sped up version of the previous thing, and you can see that these azimuths of periaps are librating in a horseshoe type pattern. Okay, so this is a horseshoe analog. Okay, so again, the massless test particle comes in, it gets a kick, which is parameterized by these green lines marking the angle. And because of the kick, the orbit will be slightly different this time, and you can tell that this angle has changed. Now we'll switch to a frame rotating with the planet. So again, the planet is stationary, particle comes in, gets a kick, which is parameterized by this angle shown by the green line. So there you go. Now we speed the whole thing up a lot. So each orbit is one frame now. And after that, we just replace each orbit with a green line. And you can see that the azimuths of periaps are librating in this horseshoe type pattern. OK. So now I'll just mention a couple implications of these horseshoe and tadpole analogs. For one thing, the widths of the horseshoes and tadpoles increase with
increasing semi-major axis of the particle. So the particle orbit gets longer or larger and more elongated, you get wider librations. So this corresponds to an increasing resonance width associated with those tadpole and horseshoe analogs. And in fact, when the semi-major axis of the particle gets large enough, the resonances, these resonances associated with the tadpole and horseshoe analogs overlap, and you get the associated chaos. So this occurs when the semi-major axis is greater than mu, the mass ratio of the planet to the star, to the minus 2/5. Okay, so this is you can think of this as an analog to Jack Wisdom's mu to the 2/7 criterion for the low eccentricity regime. So this is a high eccentricity, high semi-major axis regime. One other thing is that if your mass ratio mu is small enough, specifically if it's smaller than 5 × 10⁻⁶ or so, you can get stable circulations around the Lagrange point analogs, as well as stable librations, which are the horseshoes and tadpoles like the ones shown here. So this plot shows some examples of that. So in this plot, semi-major axis increases to the right here, and on the vertical axis is the azimuth of periaps. So these black lines here are the stable circulations, and because they're stable, they confine chaotic trajectories, other trajectories that are not stable. And these examples of these are these colored trajectories here. You can see that they can't jump across here. So what this is that if you're a particle and you've started too close in to the star, then you'll never escape from the system if you have these stable trajectories. So you can kind of think of the stable trajectories as separating sort of the low eccentricity or lower eccentricity chaotic regime, which is connected to the Wisdom chaos regime, from the large semi-major axis chaotic regime, which is characterized by that mu equals minus 2/5. That's it. Thank you. Okay, yeah, I didn't actually talk about that. So the idea is that in an eccentric orbit, you only get one important interaction, and it's going to be the one near periaps. So you should really, so the order of the resonance is really the number of important interactions you've got. Whereas in a system where you have low eccentricity, you'll get maybe more, you'll get n minus one important interactions, and so that will be the order. That's the idea.
But you didn't, I was expecting maybe you have some expansion where some other parameter you have only a constant of that parameter.
Yeah, not really. It sort of acts in a similar way, in that the strength will decrease exponentially with this new order in the highly eccentric regime. But it's not explicitly an expansion.
Okay, so we're actually supposed to finish in 20 minutes or so. How many more people want to speak? One, two, three. Okay, so I'm going to have to cut it really short, like maybe 2 minutes apiece. Okay? 2-3 minutes, because what's that? No, it's exactly. It's just show us the result, basically. Because it's a teaser. Yeah, we're supposed to go look at your...
A really long time.
Right? Okay, come on up.
Okay. Do you understand what I said?
2 minutes.
Sorry, mumble too much.
What's that?
Did I mumble too much?
No.
Sorry, I
told him
I could.
Actually, I want to show something. I want you to let somebody else go ahead, and then you can talk. It pops up. Does somebody have a presentation that doesn't require? Okay, why don't you come up? Just wait for it to start up.
I looked at the stability of dust particles, and I just saw that there was Eugenio Rivera. This is work done in collaboration with Nadia Mutu. We're both at we looked at the stability of dust particles in a Kulai Islamic data center. Also the Luma and Tantric. What this plot shows is the survival time of test particles versus the solution time of the axis. All test particles are started initially and it's just in order. And all the points here show the initial centimeter axes and basically the initial radial dispersion of all the planets. This just shows the results. And basically, there are four types of regions that have that have stable test particles. Regions which are relatively close to the star and relatively far from the star. And also regions associated with mean motion resonances. And for systems where the planets are widely separated, you can also find regions that are stable there. Although that's a very quick summary. Okay. Any questions? The thing is that Nader is not here, so he asked me to give a presentation for his course.
Any question?
Yeah.
How is the level of the for a lifetime for things that are close to the planet?
Yes. These are actually token libraries.
Yeah.
I should say that I performed N body sets for the radial velocity to get the initial conditions for each of these systems. Points have an UMA by N body fitting the international parameters, which are significantly different than the public parameters. Body fitting regime found in the out of body. Most likely it's not the last four on this system. Every single one of them is in a Georgian library. I extended the simulation and the two times test particles at the outer edges do become unstable after a sufficient amount of time. This is in response to Thank you.
Hello, I am Hiroshi Kobayashi. I investigate the effect of stellar encounter on Ezra Skylar belt. Ezra Skylar belt has three dynamical groups. I explain the classical Ezra Skylar belt object. Classical Ezra Skylar belt objects have several features. One is total mass is very small. The other is inclination is bimodal distribution. This is orbital distribution of classical Ezra Skylar belt object. This is hot population. This is cold population. Davidson and Morbide can assure the outward migration of Neptune can explain the cold population where the total mass is as small as observation, but they can not explain the origin of truncation and formation of hot population. We show the stellar encounter can explain the both of them. I showed animation of stellar encounter. This is planetesimal disk on Phaeton view. This is Hedgehog view. Let's go. In a region, star perturbation is weak, so planets can be formed. But in outer region, excitation is very strong, so the object well scattered by Neptune. So this is caused by this is orbital distribution of object in classical Ezra Skylar belt after stellar encounter. Blue dot shows after stellar encounter. Red dot means observation. This is hot population. So the stellar encounter can explain. The object is. Object has small mass, as small as observation. So the stellar encounter can explain depletion and formation of hot population. Thank you.
Okay. Hello. My name is Masanumi Ito, and we investigate the gravitational interaction between a planet and optically thin protoplanetary disk, taking account of radiative transfer. A planet excites two density waves on both sides of the planet orbit. Due to wave excitation, the planet gives the density wave the angular momentum. On the other hand, due to wave damping, the density wave gives the disk the angular momentum. In this study, we examine the radiative transfer on wave excitation and damping in the linear calculation. This is a typical result of density distribution. This is a closer view of on the planet. We find the inclined density distribution. That this is caused by radiative cooling. We also calculate the transported angular momentum. This green line shows the angular momentum. The planet gives the density wave. The wave propagates and damping. So the density wave gives the disk the angular momentum presented by this red line. This peak caused by inclined density distribution. This red line makes the disk the gap. Using this result, we calculate the gap formation around the planet. This is the gap formation and radial direction and normalized surface density. The planet is here. Now planet migrates inward, so gap is asymmetric. This asymmetric gap causes a feedback torque. This feedback torque depends on planet mass. If the planet mass is more than 4 Earth masses, the planet migration stops. In future work, we have to compare with the previous study, Ward and Lafko, and so on. Thank you. That's all.
I'm Keiko Atobe from Tokyo Institute of Technology. I have investigated obliquity variations of terrestrial planets in habitable zone. Obliquity variations have influence on planetary climate, so its variation is important to consider the habitability of a planet. We calculated its obliquity variation using analytical formula. This is an example. Color contour shows obliquity amplitude. We have investigated what the perturbing planets have influence on the habitable zone. This result suggests that perturbing planets, which make the orbits of terrestrial planets marginally stable, cause large obliquity variation in habitable zone. We examined obliquity variations in 85 non-extrasolar planetary systems. Our calculation indicates there are 17 systems which can have terrestrial planets with stable orbits and small obliquity variation. However, most of them are single planet system containing cross-in giant planet. If such a planet migrating outer region, terrestrial planets would be expelled and cannot exist in this region, in this system. So this result suggests terrestrial planets in stable orbits with small obliquity variations may be rare. If you have any question, let's discuss together after this session. Thank you very much.
Okay, wait. So you're going to go as well? You have a presentation as well? All right. On there? That's efficient, too.
Hello, my name is Arika Higuchi. I'm working with Dr. Ichiro Kokubo in NAOJ. I'm very interested in the old cloud and the extrasolar comet cloud. The big two parameters which determine the comet cloud is the planetary system and the galactic environment. I treat these two parameters separately. Now I'm working on the first parameter, the planetary system. This parameter is dominant in the former part of the formation process. And the parameter or planetary system is characterized by these parameters of planet and planetesimals. What I want to know is the efficiency of collision or ejection or planetesimals, and that depends on these parameters. To evaluate these dependencies, I calculated the probability of escape and collision of planetesimals. Escape means the ejection from the solar system, from the planetary system, and collision means a collision between planetesimals with a planet. This is an example of the result. It is plotted the P, probability of escape and collision versus the major axis of planetesimal. Using these results, now I obtain the efficiency of escape and collision. The efficiency is defined as this formula. This is one example of the result. This figure shows the efficiency of collision and escape versus eccentricity. And also, I plot the fitting formula of this efficiency with the result of numerically calculated. Using this efficiency, we can estimate the escape and collision efficiency without numerical calculation. If you have any interest or questions, let's discuss at my poster. Thank you.
I'm Makiko Nagasawa from UC Santa Cruz. I'm prepared for a 2 minutes talk, but time is rushing, so I only show the result of my most recent observation. Yeah, thank you.
So we're officially supposed to be done now. Do people want to continue briefly, or you want to just go get a beer?
You should wrap it up.
What have we learned? Yeah, well, where's my little sheet? Yeah. I don't need both of these. Maybe.
I guess I'd say the thing that sort of struck me the most was that people are really concentrating on trying to form the outer giant planets. Doug was, Rain was, Stu wasn't maybe looking to do that, but in fact he ended up doing it. Okay. So that seems to me the thing that, well, that remains to be seen for all three of the above, eh? Yeah. We know they're there, so it works somehow or other, but it's not clear how. And I think everybody's aware that you need to have some form of damping. And several have been proposed, and they all seem to me to have drawbacks. So I'd say that, you know, I'm not convinced by any of them. But at least people are thinking about it and you know, making some progress. I mean, in the past, people would have said, well, it takes, you know, 10 billion years to form Neptune. Well, we're doing a little better than that. Now it takes a reasonable amount of time, and we have all this extra junk left over, typically, I think, is what the problem is. So that was one of the things that really struck me. I was struck also by, a couple of different results that we heard about sort of on the sides. Well, the first one was Yan Shin's talk and also Gordon's work with Doug on a possible mechanism for tidal dissipation in Jupiter's and possibly in other objects, stars even. And I think that's really the most significant development I've heard about in the field for quite a while. I think that's really an interesting result. Now, of course, neither of them actually claim to have gotten the right answer yet, but it looks pretty promising. I did notice that there was a paper by Doug and Gordon on the printer out there. I don't know if it showed up in AstroPH yet. Okay. And we're awaiting one from Yan Shin and Phil here. Okay. The other striking result, which actually has been around for a little while, is type 3 migration. And what I thought was nice is that we saw a little bit of a physical explanation for what was going on. I think that needs to continue. I'm going to make the same comment actually about the eccentricity, excitation mechanism from disks, for example. Gordon mentioned that Frederic Massé has been doing some work on showing that if you put a potential, or a single component of the planetary potential, and apply that to a disk, that in fact the co-rotation resonance will saturate, and therefore supporting the idea of Sari and Goldreich that might lead to eccentricity growth. On the other hand, I think there's a lot more work to be done there. That's a very simple toy model, and real planets may behave very differently than that. So clearly there's a lot of work to be done, okay? What else have I got written down here? The observational talks I thought were amazing. I mean, there's no way to summarize them. There's just a lot of information available now. And I think that's one thing that people have to spend some time doing, learning a bit more phenomenology, because I think a lot of people have had the reaction or the experience that Doug had this morning that, you know, there's some fact that somebody else knows about that you're not aware of that really puts a constraint on any theory that you happen to make. And I think people should devote a bit more time to reading the observational literature and going to talks like those of Lynn and no, it shouldn't stop you. I mean, it's also true that, you know, just because there's some fact that disagrees with the theory of yours, if you think you have some physical understanding, then I think you are, in fact, free to ignore the observation. Observations clearly change with time, okay? Things that are true now won't be true 5 years from now, but you at least should be aware of them so you're thinking about how you might get around it. Those are the sort of things that struck me during this past week. If anybody else, the other thing I should mention is that a lot more attention is being put into work like Andrew's and Derek's, where people are trying to build up from small bodies to, well, some size or other that's more amenable to treatment. And I think that's, again, an area where there's plenty of room for more work. So students in particular should be aware of this. On the other hand, it's clear that it's not going to be easy. Okay. All right, so I think that's enough for me. If people want to have a general discussion, I think this would be a good time to launch into it. So any other questions? I know Mark here has something he would like to say. Anybody else? All right, go ahead.
All right, so thanks, Norm. All right, so I wanted to tell you my story of the formation of planetary systems based on a series of surveys of people taken mostly while they were trying to get dinner. I would stand over by the salad dressing, and as they walked by, I would ask them a question. So thanks everyone for participating. It's a slightly different picture than Doug's talk. All right, so I want to start out with something that Lynn Hillenbrand told us. First of all, that at any given time, in a cluster of forming stars, we have simultaneously stars with and without disks. Okay, what this says to me is that, apologies to Stu, but the minimum mass solar nebula is a pile of BS. It's neither minimum nor mass. okay, that's not true. I was just playing with it this week and appreciating all the different variations that you can make with it. The usual story that we can concoct for the description of the mass profile of the disk is based on spreading the planets out, taking the planets we have and spreading them out into these annuli. But of course, all of that mass doesn't have to be there at the same time. In fact, usual story about how to get turbulence in the disk involves saturated MRI instability, and that saturates at roughly alpha of 0.1. You could argue that maybe if you ionize the entire disk by cosmic rays, that you could have a very quick removal of all the gas. You could end up with a situation where the planets form in a gas-starved disk, something like Bill and Robin's story for the formation of the Galilean satellites. And as far as I can tell, this is consistent with observations. The usual picture we have of a slowly depleting disk of minimum mass solar nebula might not be true. Okay, second major point. There's been some talk about snow lines and such. There's no observational evidence for any sort of lump of mass, whether it's solids or gas, at the snow line. There does seem to be evidence for a lump of material at the dust line, right? So Lynn Hillenbrand showed this ever-popular model of the T-Tauri disk structure, where it shows this tall inner wall at roughly 0.1 AU. All right, that comes out of the spectral energy distributions, which have a prominent lump at 3 microns over and over again in T-Tauri and Herbig AE stars. And it appears in optical interferometry in measurements of the sizes of these disks at K-band. All right, so there's observational evidence for a collection of material where you could collect dust. And so if we can collect material there, and we also have a story for how to what to do if we formed a planet there. Pavel and I talking about this last night. Maybe we should revisit this idea of in situ formation of hot Jupiters, actually form them, where we have this pile up of material. This is something else that came out of my survey. I kept asking people, is there any reason why we can't possibly form the hot Jupiters where we have this pile up of material? And nobody had a good reason. Okay, and my last point is that as we're picturing this disk disappearing, and I'm arguing that maybe it doesn't slowly disappear, maybe it's here sometimes and gone sometimes, but if you picture that in late stages you have less gas than you had in earlier stages, two things. One is that the secular resonance sweeping story isn't quite right, because secular resonance is launched apsidal waves, and we learned throughout this week that we don't really understand exactly what's going on, exactly the physics of that. But one thing is that it will change the location of the secular resonances. And two, when you lose material in the gas, you also cool down the disk. That moves in the snow line, allows you to potentially deposit water onto the Earth without needing comets or asteroids, and maybe even get on the argon onto Jupiter. Okay, so that's my provocative results of my survey here. Thanks.
Okay, any comments people want to? Yeah, Hal, go ahead. Just yell.
Anything about whether the Earth was built at a possible time? Is there anything about the reluctance of the state of the world or the earth? the Earth has a giant impact, and we don't understand the gravity. I think probably it's a
What fraction of water are you asking about? Half? No, I don't think the density wouldn't be high enough then. Yeah. Yeah. If you put in anything remotely like half, the density is going to be way too low. He's saying just for a short period of time. Okay.
That's a good question.
He was trying to be provocative, not correct. Any They do show some alteration from water for some of them, but not evidence of a lot of water. So if you coated them with a layer of ice that was substantial and then you'd get rid of it later, you'd have to be very careful not to have any of it drain into it, or not a small fraction of it drain into it. Anyway, I don't know. I think we're probably done for the day, and I think we did a pretty good job. I would like to thank, first of all, KITP for organizing the whole thing. Yeah, I was just going to say, let's get Sue, because she's been riding herd on everybody and doing a very good job. And you guys need riding herd on. So let's hang on. Let's wait for Sue. Okay, so here's Sue. Thank you. Great. Also, I'd like to thank Doug Early for running the audio video. So he says, rather than give him a hand, hand him your slides, give him your copies, make his life easier, okay? So everybody, please do that. And we're free to discuss afterwards on our own, so have a nice day. Oh, wait. Oh, well, yes, the most important, the director of KITP has graced us with his presence here, so I think it was incumbent upon us to thank him. We've really enjoyed, most of us, the last three months, basically, but the rest of the conference attendance as well, I think. So thank you very much. Ah, we have a van. So we're done. It's going to leave in 10 minutes.
Let me just add, as somebody who's been here for 3 months, I'd like to thank Norm and Doug, not only for that three-month period, but especially for the last week of really stimulating meeting. Thank you very much, both of you.